So I think the first question is to describe your...
Yeah, let me give you a brief background. I've been associated with the nuclear weapons program at the National Laboratory since 1971. I have been in a variety of roles. Primarily, the first bulk of my career, the first 35 years of those, were in association with the Livermore Laboratory. And then a one-year stint at the University of California Office of the President, but still directly assisting the three labs that UC operates, Berkeley, of course, Los Alamos, and Livermore. And then with the contract competition, after 60-plus years of essentially the government relying upon the University of California to run all of the labs and solely management, there was a decision by Congress to that contract competition. I was part of the team that Mike Anastasio, the current laboratory director, assembled to compete for that contract. Of course, that started in 2006, and here we are approaching the second anniversary of that change. So that's the background. My scientific technical background has been in weapons material science R&D, and it included working directly on materials that entered the stockpile were part of certification. It went up to and included a direct role in leading the Livermore Labs underground nuclear test program for a number of years, including ushering in the era of the moratorium in 1992 when the U.S. Ceased the underground nuclear testing in Nevada. And at that time, we transitioned to subcritical experiments in the stewardship program to basically allow annual certification of safety, reliability, and surety of that stockpile without procuring underground testing since then. And I've had a variety of roles programmatically and technically and administratively for the execution of labs. Last role at Livermore was the deputy director, as my conversation was deputy. So that's a little bit of my background, and it does include extensive involvement with our British colleagues. Obviously, my experience with underground nuclear testing brought me very up close and personal to that experience. Second question is with regard to the formation of the agreement in 1958. Well, that precedes me by a good number of years. So my role in that formulation really does go to the Schlesinger and the Harold Agnew population. I'll refer to their answers to parts A through D. When I came on board into the program, we already had a very mature and active collaboration. And let me describe that briefly. It was always one of technical exchange within the confines and the limits of that agreement. There were certain areas that were off limits. But in terms of basic science, engineering, there were considerable latitude. And so in those early days, we were very much involved in understanding materials of interest to the national security and the weapons program. And those collaborations were extremely valuable and very open. And it was very refreshing to be able to have colleagues who had excellent technical credentials, but who had different perspectives and a different background experience. So those activities were very rich and very valuable. As they matured and resulted in the exchanges that were mutually beneficial and the most, I'll call it intimate sharing, was that when we conducted joint experiments together. And when the British ended their testing capabilities and relied solely on the U.S. capability at the Nevada test site, then that partnership began to where they would either field add-ons to a variety of experiments, or we would host directly their entire experiment, and we might provide some add-ons. Those experiments were and still remain some of the most complicated, most detailed, most well-executed experiments that were done in history of the United States. A little more on that. If I talk about the highlights, and in my recollections of our cooperation under that agreement, call for use that as a bit of a preamble to describe just one particular underground test, Barkwell. When you looked at the richness and the attention to detail that our British experimentalists and British engineers would bring to an experiment, it was always impressive to all of the U.S. colleagues, their attention. Part of it was due to the fact that they treated every experiment for which they had an opportunity as a unique opportunity because they only had limited occasions to exercise them. You might say the U.S. counterparts, all of us were a bit spoiled with a much more robust and rich test opportunity. So they made every attempt to wring every lance out, every last ounce of productivity, and their attention to detail, their pre-shot calculations, their pre-engineering, the documentation of their experiment in advance, really did bring a level of rigor that in many cases was more outstandingly documented and thought through than the U.S. counterparts. And that's one of the things that I think we learned from them, because oftentimes in our execution, to go after the data or the experiment, we were not as deliberative and as critical in the early phases to design that experiment as the U.S. counterparts. So that discipline, that appreciation, and that rigor is something that I think was one of their most significant accomplishments in bringing to the agreement and sharing with us as U.S. counterparts. The other features that I think were really critical, their peer review. Having an organization which insisted on their own ethics, their own codes, their own simulations, as well as their own complementary experiments that they could do on K-soil, afforded them a fresh look which we appreciated in the way of critique. It was important in the early phases of the agreement during the year of testing. It's even more important now than the year of testing. So we value the true peer review. They have been there every step of the way. I have even now a growing commitment to their own intellectual independence of their program. And that's witnessed by their commitment to what we call enhanced collaboration. That's the latest chapter in our agreement with them. And it's witnessed by the fact that they want their own weapons codes from supercomputing, and we totally support the concept that they not just borrow entirely and depend on U.S. intellectual prowess to the basic physics that are in their codes. That is even more highly valued than before in the early phases when we could all go to Nevada and truth could ultimately be given where we are with the tools of stewardship and their own investments in their independent tools and capabilities. The value of this collaboration can only increase rather than diminish. And so we put a real premium on that. It's going to be born with some challenges. They are going to be examining their future of their nuclear deterrent capability and how they will either extend it or modernize it. And they've got decisions. They closely watch what the U.S. policy will be. Will we transform the stockpile with something akin to the RRW design and approach that had been in the works? That will clearly be determined in future policy discussions and reviews. But they independently will be going through their own decisions on how their systems are either modernized or upgraded. Regardless of that future and regardless of the policy decisions, given the independence that each organization affords in what is technologically feasible and possible, brings a level of additional intellectual honesty to each of our pursuits. So that benefit and our valuing that benefit, again, I see that increases. What are the pressures that might limit the potential agreement? In general, what we found or what I observed is that the pressures to either limit the nuclear expertise base are opening up to a broader range rather than them having access to a broader range of, some would say, our experimental data, and it appears that both countries are moving in that direction. those, assuming we can remove some of those barriers, the value of these collaborations will increase with that. So I see that adding. I don't see anything that is likely, at least in the immediate future, to finish that round. I think all of the signs point to that direction. And again, I think as we downsize our nuclear deterrent, as we make it safer, more secure, and more reliable, as we downsize the complex, there can be nothing but an upside associated with that. Are there other pressures that compete? It has always been somewhat cumbersome at the rate of exchange of classified information to go through all of the appropriate approvals. There are attempts now to streamline the process. There are also attempts to streamline the ability to share experimental parts configurations, and that also will aid. But today, or at least in the past, those have been impediments to the rate of progress. And so those pressures I see starting to lessen. We'll see whether we can achieve the transparency that we'd like on those two areas. Transmittal of information as well as transmittal of material and experiments. What in particular were the benefits to the United States in cooperation? I think I've covered that, but to summarize it, fresh, independent perspective, scientific independence, and rigorous peer review. That in a nutshell is really the leverage of this collaborative. Next question is, how's the character of that cooperation changed over the last 50 years? How did the arms control culminated in the Blair sales division. Well, the character I've covered is that in part, and with regard to arms treaties and the like, in terms of our collaboration, I don't see them changing. There's generally been an increasing slope through all of the international agreements to enhance and expand the collaboration. And in fact, the end of testing in the current moratorium, have a treaty, but we're committed to the moratorium. Those driving forces on the national scale have only served to help strengthen the command and add to the importance of the agreement. And I think that's likely to continue independent of any scenario that I can envision, at least for the foreseeable future. So as we approach this 50-year anniversary and we've been discussing enhanced collaboration agreements, I think it's just going to accelerate to their being here in firm. The only thing that will change is what will be the scope. If the U.S. embarks on an aggressive transformation of the stockpile to smaller, safer, more reliable, then that will increase and accelerate. If the U.S. adopts a posture of legacy Cold War stockpile and to contain that, that will not be as aggressive, but it will be equal. That's how I would say it's likely to be close. What are the prospects for future collaboration? Is there a case for increased mutual interdependence? The answer is absolutely. The interdependence of having independent viewpoints and peer review in a world without underground testing is absolutely increasing. Demands greater mutual independence. Second part, how might the agreement the exchanges under its auspices need to be changed to better serve? As I said, we need to break down a few barriers. Greater transparency into some of our data and experience so that they can validate their calculations and predictions and better peer review ours, I think is one area where the agreement can further breaking down the ease with which we can mobilize data and transfer across lines will again facilitate that, as well as some actual hardware and experiments. Clearly collaborate on them, plan to continue to collaborate, and accelerate those and the ease with which we can do those, that actual mutually beneficial experimental work will help facilitate. And I think we're moving in that direction. What will the agreement look like in 50 years' time? I hazard to guess what 50 years will bring. I think nuclear weapons will still be around. In any scenario, the long-term relationship that served the first 50 years, I find it hard to believe that the mutual benefit in this area of technology and mutual national security is going to change dramatically. The long-term working relationship and the commonality of our two countries is not, in my opinion, likely to be broken, and is likely to continue to mature. So I expect that will it still exist. That would be my expectation. What will be the role of nuclear weapons in NATO? That's a harder question to answer. My own perspective is that our European allies rely on a strong NATO, and that a nuclear capability is a portion of that. How large a portion of that will maintain, very hard to predict. As the stockpile goes down, we achieve greater gains in nation states and downsizing nuclear arsenals. I would look toward continued progress in that regard. Just recently, I know that the current president of France has announced his decision to downsize his total arsenal. We're downsizing ours. Tom Dodds, you know, just in the height of the Cold War, one of his press conferences, I believe the number of use was a decrease of approximately 75% from peak levels. Every president since the Cold War has announced the intention to have the smallest, safest, most secure stockpile consistent with national security. That vector, I don't see changing on the horizon. And so, but I think NATO will clearly be a factor with a smaller, safer, more secure stockpile. And ultimately, we'll see how far we can go for it. Ultimately, not relying on the nuclear weapons, but they are here. They're going to be here for the foreseeable future. And I certainly applaud the role of NATO in getting that to a small, safe, and secure return. So I can see continued progress there. How will increasing the technical cooperation with Russia and France impact the NDA? Just add to it. Any of the collaborations and cooperation with France adds the same level of additional scientific independence, the perspective, aspects of peer and scientific review, any and all of those kinds of capabilities, I am a strong proponent. And I'll harken back to some past views held by some of our prior leaders in the national program. In this case, I'll use Edward Teller. In discussing with Teller some of the role of deterrence, not that it's based in numbers, it was a conversation we had once with regard to collaborating with the Russians, at which time we were doing joint verification. And we were talking about how transparent one would be in measuring yield versus letting them see closer in to the device for our diagnosis. And at that point in his life, in his career, I don't think it changed dramatically. His view was, Glenn, why are you worried about that measurement or that? Really, the strength of our deterrent is as much based in the Russians knowing how good we are and how capable we are and how powerful our scientific knowledge and our expertise is that we can execute any and all of these experiments, and that for a certain level, more transparency is necessary. And there's great wisdom in that, that our national security is in large part not built on how many weapons are there, but is at least as important that any adversary or potential adversary realize that this country and its scientific and engineering prowess can do everything that it is, and its technical excellence is secondary. And I think those are pretty wise words. So in terms of cooperation with Russia, France, allies, potential adversaries, any future, having the rest of the world recognize the true power of our scientific and technical capability to be agile and responsive to anything, I think serves us well. So expanding those cooperations, I think, will serve that same thing. Excellent evolution of the report. I remember very well the height of the Cold War when I participated in certain exchanges outside of weapons, in this case, fusion energy. Still had, at the height of the Cold War, some technical exchanges. And even at that point, when tensions were at fairly high levels, the benefit of scientific and technical counterparts having exchanges and recognizing the mutual respect, and recognizing the tenuous path that we were on during the height of the Cold War, really brought the benefit for having that perspective. With the end of the Cold War, when laboratory directors, in this case Sig Hecker, was part of the leading envoy, if you will, in breaking through some of what had been very, very rigorous barriers, has served nothing but me. So again, I look forward to the next chapters of those cooperations, technical side. Part F, what are the prospects for further bilateral arms controls with Russia? Is there a realistic prospect of a multilateral nuclear arms control treaty in the future? How can the special relationship on the NDA serve against that? I think those of us who put our career in national security nuclear weapons continue to have the hope that further arms reductions, further efforts to reduce the nuclear danger of all the nuclear haves and the nuclear aspirants. I would like to think that all of the efforts that went into ending the Cold War can be built upon and continue to further progress in all of the arms control agreements of all the weapons nation states. And we'll see. We've had some limited successes where certain nation states have downsized or gotten out of their nuclear efforts. We're witnessing what will happen now with North Korea. We saw what happened with Korea. We see other states that seem to be intent, or at least would give the appearance of wanting to become nuclear weapon states. I think Russia, I think ourselves, France, and all of the countries who are nuclear haves, we can lead by example further bilateral reductions or even multilateral reductions, hopefully can continue the progress that's been made, and that we won't see growth in many proliferation states. That being said, it's probably worth noting that many people who look at the nuclear threat and their danger view that nuclear nation states, weapon states, is not today the largest threat, rather it's the rogue or pseudo organizations that would be bent on terrorism, but necessarily don't have the stature of nation states. And that probably is the greatest barrier. But continued progress on the nation states is certainly warranted and certainly the right direction to go. Number seven, what is your advice for the next generation of nuclear policy makers, scientists and technologists who have the opportunity to work together? That is a good one. There's a couple of pieces of advice. In order to reduce further nuclear danger, in the path of scientific excellence, scientific stewardship, stockpile transformation, smaller, safer, more secure, there are challenges to achieve that reality or that end state. The scientific tools we've invested in since the end of testing in 92, and with the maturation of our computational capability, taking more of the mystery and the empiricism out of our basic predictive codes and our models, all of that will allow for a smaller, safer, more secure stockpile across the world, not only in the U.S., okay, in this case being the obvious example. Also, should rely, resulting in a much smaller support infrastructure. Hence, that means that the safety of our workers, the safety of the public, any and all future environmental insults can be controlled. In fact, it's very achievable that a site like Los Alamos, which is a key nuclear site, will, before too long, be a zero-discharge site, where we will not have a preponderance of liquid discharges to the environment, or for that matter, the nuclear operations. All of that process chemistry and process engineering can be greatly reduced to reduce, again, any and all waste streams and appropriately dispose of them in a safe fashion. And in large part, no longer will we commit the sins of the Cold War or the post-World War II era. All of the sites partly through ignorance, but partly through a different sense of priorities, resulted in severe insults and environmental, I'll call it, irresponsibility. And we've certainly learned our lessons from the early days. And all of that, the stewardship, the tools, and the transformation, all will move in that direction. Probably the best example is the current preferred alternative. The generated waste from the inferred stockpile that the landfill as a site alone will generate will be less than what we're generating today. We know how to change our processing. We know how to eliminate entire material streams that are toxic or otherwise hazardous that don't need part of the inferred stockpile. Those are the challenges for the next generation of policymakers, scientists, and engineers. We believe that the tools of stewardship have allowed us a path to make that kind of progress. And you can't do that with a legacy Cold War stockpile, but you can do that with a transform stockpile. Those will be challenges for the future policymakers. Is that more stable? Is that more reassuring to our allies? And is it a greater deterrent to potential adversaries? I believe it is. I don't believe it's a new nuclear capability that's militarily more effective or that's nuclear weapons more likely to be used. I think done properly is just the opposite. So those are some big challenges for the next generation. I've been fortunate to spend my career through the height of the Cold War, where I was working on many weapons at one time and many things going into the stockpile. I am delighted to be, through my career, to see that trend having been reversed in civilian productions. And I see that the next generation has the opportunity to build on what's occurred since the end of the Cold War. And if we invest in the tools of stewardship, the tools of transformation, and the scientists and engineers have those challenges, we'll go a long way to achieving that. And that will allow the next generation to recruit among the best in the place. Because those are not trivial problems. The remaining anomalies and this, incomplete understanding of weapons physics and engineering can be resolved with the tools that we have at our fingertips. And that lets the stockpile move in a transformed direction much smaller, much fewer spares, much safer, much more easily contained, fewer toxic, fewer radioactive materials. It's a win-win on virtually every level. And it will take several decades to achieve that transformation. But the net result is a much smaller infrastructure while still allowing and affording an appropriate measure of national security. So those are probably the future that I see. And it is exciting. And I think there will be young scientists and engineers that will want to further transform the world of nuclear deterrence. And that last question, how best can this knowledge and the experience be transferred to the next and preserved for the next generation? The answer is with real work, real execution of scientific tools of stewardship applied to making a safer, secure, smaller, enduring stockpile, I think will be the best way to preserve that information. Real work, real technical challenges. So that's about it.
Thank you, Mike. That's fantastic information.
Let me offer one or two other more personal anecdotes besides the policy, the scientific, the technical. One of the things that I hearken back over those 50 years are some of the personalities and some of the personal relationships that are as precious and are as important as the national agreements between countries. When you're doing really tough, demanding experiments or any kind of technical challenge, it breaks down many of the barriers that language or culture or any other impediments might exist. And so when you team up with a team of British counterparts to go and do something that's really demanding and challenging, you help afford that opportunity. Among my fondest memories of working with the Brits during those most grueling times when you're having problems with a detector or a diagnosis or you can't make it work or you don't make it work, the camaraderie that's shared under the trial of that duress really builds long-lasting friendships and mutual respect, and it's manifested in several ways. I can recall spirited volleyball games at a test site after 12-hour days when people needed to relax and turn away from them. I can remember cricket games on the U.S. ball diamond at the Nevada test site where the U.S. folks had to learn a few things about how cricket is played. And they would bring over their cricket bats and their equipment and teach us, and then we would in turn challenge them to a softball game. So whatever the occasion and whatever was the environment, we would find a way to take the stress and the trials of demanding scientific and technical pursuits and find a way also to enjoy each other's company and learn from each other. And the spirited both competition and camaraderie included bowling tournaments. You name it, we found ways to partner and enjoy each other's company in many, many ways. That really is a fond set of memories where really good, technically dedicated people work hard and play hard and work together. And Clive Marsh has been through the program through a long time. He just now retired, one of their physics and scientific leaders. And the many people that worked with me and his colleagues, those are some very, very special times. And some of the most demanding physics experiments were done in a lot of those collaborations, and both sides learned an incredible amount about the programs that wouldn't have been possible. So that human touch and those relationships are just absolutely precious, and I think those of us who've been lucky enough to be a part of them really will treasure those for the balance of our careers. You know, most of us, and I'm, they can probably talk to her at the twilight of their careers, but it's really a special opportunity. So these international collaborations and the fact that the laboratories are so rich with our foreign collaborators, whether it be basic science, or in this case, right to the heart of the weapons program, they serve to keep these research organizations extremely vital, extremely fresh, and infused with creative ideas. It has multiple benefits on dimensions that you don't appreciate just in a linear addition of specific activity. So they really are to be treasured, valued, and nurtured.
So in that vein, have you found that the colleagues that you've worked with in the UK become friends and visit with them on a less technical level?
Certainly, the opportunity to visit around the work, and some of them have become more, I'll call it, socially engaged. To the point that there are examples of British colleagues, some of whom change their citizenship and ultimately become U.S. citizens and become essentially enmeshed in the program. In fact, I think, while I wouldn't want it for attribution, our British colleagues worry about that, that generally that is more of a one-way street from there to here. There's a reason for that. We have some of the best toys to play with. Their budgets are and have been historically a little more meager. We have a DART, we have a DIN, and we have the supercomputer. So there generally has been a draw to the U.S. because of our technical prowess and because we are in many, many areas right in the state of the art with very large availability of the equipment to do some of the more state-of-the-art experiments and calculations and models. But I think we've been very respectful, recognizing that we don't want to be a brain drain on their cadre of folks. But some of those have nurtured into permanent relationships, up and including people in transition. And then there are people who have considered upon retirement buying property and having a second home in the UK, others on other foreign soils. There's no question personal level of attachment and comfort with the other person's culture and environment has led to some long-standing enduring relationships that are very unique. I haven't made any of those decisions personally, though I owns my property, but I treasure every trip I make over to the UK and join the convention each time. So, and they've always been open, warm, and hospitable. In fact, I would even say almost to a fault. Sometimes I think those of us on the U.S. side, we sometimes take for granted the hospitality of our UK counterparts has always been warm, probably even warmer than what we extended to them. But that's been extremely special.
On the topic of treaties and pressures from treaties, their posture would be changing the relationship and conflict with non-cooperation.
It's hard for me to predict what the next nuclear posture would be. Obviously, the last one is 2002. And born out of the last one, we are on the precipice of this enhanced cooperation. So it's clear the last formal posture would be nothing to change. In fact, it would be a richer, more extensive set of collaborations. I believe that's going to be robust against any future, whether we do tend to the old stockpile or whether we transform to a more modern, safer, secure stockpile. One can define those enhanced collaborations that are valuable for either of those regions. With an upcoming nuclear posture review, and there certainly will be with the change of national leadership and administration, yes, it's absolutely time to revisit that. So when I look at all of the, I'll call it international agreements or treaties, are they likely to move us in a direction that would put this 50-year-long collaboration at risk? Is it likely to be status quo, or will it likely to move in the direction of enhanced collaboration? And for essentially any future, I see the enhanced collaboration still likely to happen. Obviously, all of us on a technical level advise policymakers as appropriate. We don't create the policy. But I would be really surprised if any of these kind of agreements or posture reviews would change the fundamental value of the relationship. I think it will likely increase rather than diminish. Can't predict that with certainty, but I think all the forces will push in that direction.
Has the UK signature of the CPTPP played a role in keeping them out of the enhanced collaboration?
I would say the international agreement, CPTPP, their own reviews, and of course the Brits have made the decision to modernize their submarine force, and obviously modernize, if you will, their nuclear deterrent, whether they go with a transformed nuclear design or whether they extend the life of existing companies. So if I take the agreements, international agreements, the treaties, they have an effect, but not as big an effect as the following. The enhanced collaboration, what the agreement looks like, is probably more dependent on what both countries do to make their decisions for their nuclear deterrent. Let me illustrate the following. If the U.S. does not modernize in the near future and go to a transformed stockpile, rather extends the life of existing design, well, within the framework of the current design, and we know that going to transform the stockpile, you have to go to RRW designs rather than life extension, definitely. If we, in the U.S., make the decision one way or the other, that will have a more dramatic effect on enhanced collaboration within the agreement than our likelihood to continue directions for reducing reliance on numbers of weapons and the types of weapons. So it's more the character of the technical definition of the nuclear deterrence than it's likely, at least in the foreseeable future, that I see the nature of the international agreements. One way to put it is if the U.S. decides to extend the legacy stockpile, regardless of what numbers are agreed to or the nature of testing, it is much more difficult for the U.K. to embark on a transformed stockpile, and I can go it alone. Because there are so many interdependencies, just on the evolution of their return to China. So those technical factors, that part of the policy decision, which is it won't be tied to stockpile numbers so much, but more will be the character of the return. In large part, that is, I would expect the UK, in many regards, to follow the U.S. We'll see whether that turns out to be the case. It's clear that the UK would like to be a more fully independent, more complete in terms of their nuclear competence. The better they are fully complete, the better they can do peer review, the better we'll get an independent assessment of our technical issues. But I would say I don't see any real impediments to either our posture, theirs, or the treaties that will diminish in any way the big collaborations.
Do you have any other comments you'd like to have?
The only other comment is my sincere appreciation for what has been an absolutely outstanding set of collaborations and benefits that we both individually have derived from the relationship, and that I hope to see it continue well into the future.
Thank you, Glenn Maher, for visiting and answering these questions. Today is March 28th, and it's about 5 a.m. Los Alamos.
Sounds good, sir.
All right, thank you.
You bet.